This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
How often are politicians helping their mates into good jobs? Maybe more often than you think. A report into Jobs for Mates has some pretty damning findings about government appointments to boards. And after 2 years, we're only seeing this report now. So why has it taken so long and how big of a problem is it? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're talking nepotism and Jobs for Mates.
We found that almost every single resources minister, with a couple of exceptions, after they left politics, surprise, surprise, they went and worked for the resources industry.
Yeah, there's a lot to this. We're going to get into that chat very soon. Also ahead, can Oscar Piastri still win the Formula One world title? We'll be checking in there. First though,
Hack.
If you can't trust the people beside you, if you are going to work scared, that has a massive impact on your ability to do your job and how your team functions.
On Triple J.
Yeah, heads up, we're about to talk about sexual violence for the next few minutes. Because we know sexual assault in the Defence Force has been a big issue for a long time. I don't know if this surprises you, but in the last financial year alone, there have been more than 200 reports of sexual assault in the ADF. So what's being done about it? Well, today, the government announced an inquiry. But will it actually lead to a culture change within the ADF? Our political reporter Shalala Madora has more.
I proudly served in the Australian military for 7.5 years.
Becky McGaw signed up for the Air Force when she was 17 years old. Very soon after, she was sexually assaulted by a fellow recruit.
I experienced military sexual trauma very early on in my career during recruit training.
Becky says even now, more than 7 years later, not a single person has paid for what was done to her.
The fellow recruit has never been reprimanded for his actions. The matter was never deferred to civilian police, as is not only military policy, but legislation. And the chain of command who actively protected my perpetrator and purposely hid it have never been reprimanded.
According to the Department of Defence's annual report, 215 reports of sexual offences were made in the last financial year alone.
Some of those reports that were made in that last financial year do relate to historical events, so they didn't all occur necessarily in that year. But frankly, one is too many.
Veterans Affairs Minister Matt Keogh today launched a new inquiry into sexual violence in the Australian Defence Forces. The inquiry was a recommendation of the Royal Commission into Veterans Suicide, which the government responded to 12 months ago.
Not only does sexual violence cause serious harm to individuals, it undermines defence and impacts our operational effectiveness.
The inquiry will start in the middle of next year and will include research by the Human Rights Commission into the effects of military sexual trauma. The minister had this message for perpetrators.
If you engage in sexual violence, you can presume that you no longer have a job in our Defence Force.
He's going to introduce new laws to make it easier to fire perpetrators within the ADF and make them more accountable to the broader public.
From next week, Defence will be reporting service convictions of sexual and related offences to the National Police Reference System. This means that personnel who commit civilian equivalent offences can no longer hide their conduct within the military justice system.
We look forward to trying to support this inquiry.
The Greens welcome the inquiry, but Senator David Shoebridge says the government needs to chuck out senior ADF personnel who've brushed sexual violence under the rug.
The problem with defence is the more gold braid you have on your shoulder, the more immune you are. If you want to know what accountability looks like, it means sacking some of these toxic senior members of the ADF who have permitted this culture to happen for years.
The Coalition also welcomes the inquiry and told Hack in a statement that they want current serving members to be offered anonymity so they can come forward without fear.
A lot of the senior officers protecting others, it's uniformed nepotism at best. So I always hope when action comes into the public light that there will be some accountability.
Becky McGaw is cautiously optimistic about the inquiry, but wants to make sure it leads to real change.
Is it actually going to benefit victim survivors, or is it just going to be another reason for senior officers to get awards or another campus course or mandatory training that the Defence Force has to do?
Chairwoman of advocacy group The Athena Project, Donna Manton, is worried it's all happening too fast, with the government rushing the consultation period with victim survivors like her.
And the consultation period they've given us is December, January, which of course everyone's away, you won't get ADF people.
She says the only way the inquiry will succeed is if victim survivors have buy-in.
We need to look at why previous cultural changes haven't worked. To me, accountability is the key to that.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Medora reporting then. A reminder, if this story has raised issues for you, support always available through Lifeline 13 11 14. Also through Veteran and Family Support Service Open Arms. They're on 1800 011 046.
Hack.
Jobs for mates. Frustrating when it happens in everyday life, even more so when it happens at the highest levels of politics.
On Triple J.
Yeah, has your mate ever helped you get into a job? Or maybe you've recommended someone close to you to a boss and they've got a job maybe they weren't exactly qualified for? Nepotism. It's not new. You'd like to think, though, it's not happening at the highest levels of government, except it is. And a so-called Jobs for Mates report has been made public today and spells out just how widespread this issue is. Alice Angeloni's been looking into it.
Using your connections to land a sweet gig that pays hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
In February 2023, the Minister for Public Service announced an inquiry into public board appointments to end the Jobs for Mates culture of the previous coalition government.
The hypocrisy in those interjections is breathtaking, given that when it comes to the question of appointing people to government positions, they industrialise it.
Sorting your mates out with a cushy job that pays well sounds pretty good if you're a mate, right? But what about if the mate is the federal government of Australia?
It's really frustrating because Labor and opposition railed against Scott Morrison's secrecy.
So the Labor Party's been in power in Canberra for 3.5 years now, and after its election win, it set up an inquiry into how people land cushy government board jobs. Today we learned it got the findings 2 years ago, but is only dropping them now.
The government has had over 2 years to consider its findings and has repeatedly refused to make the report public.
So what do the findings say? Well, they're scathing.
Reveals that the current system is in terrible condition.
So the report was done by a former senior official in Canberra, Linnell Briggs, and basically she's found governments appoint friends to board positions to reward loyalty or promote political priorities. She reckons in general 6 or 7% of board appointments are political, but in some areas it's as many as half.
There continues to be exactly what the public thinks, that is the appointment of friends, political friends, family and friends, failed politicians.
Linnell Briggs also reckons it's much worse here than in similar countries. In a direct quote, she said, all too often these appointments have looked like forms of patronage and nepotism.
Why did it take so long?
Because the work wasn't completed.
At a Senate hearing today, the Public Services Minister, Katie Gallagher, defended the report only being dropped now, saying the government's been working on what she calls an appointments framework to make things fairer.
Support around the appointments process probably wasn't what it should be, and that the systems were opaque across government.
The Jobs for Mates report also had its own suggestions about how to fix things, like barring politicians or their staffers from going straight to a government job after they quit. But on that one and others, the minister's saying no thanks.
We don't agree with that recommendation.
Crossbenchers like the Greens and Independents today were critical. ACT Senator David Pocock reckons it's all been a missed opportunity.
It smashes trust in political parties, in government institutions at a time where we desperately need to be rebuilding that.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there, and I'm wondering if any of this Jobs for Mates stuff surprises you. Do you assume that this is happening in government, that it's all over politics? Do you have any faith that things can change? 0439 757 555. Got messages coming in. Someone says, when is it nepotism and when is it valid networking? I don't know. I'd think that networking is about building relationships that give you opportunities, maybe. Nepotism's about being thrown into something, maybe without qualifications. That's the distinction I see. Let's talk more with someone who maybe knows a bit about the distinction. Clancy Moore, he's the CEO of Transparency International Australia, and he's with us now. Clancy, thanks for coming on.
Absolute pleasure.
Have we got a nepotism problem in Australian politics and the public service? What do you reckon?
Look, the report by former Public Service Commissioner Linnell Briggs states clearly that there is an issue around nepotism. Unfortunately, this, as the report clearly states, kind of diminishes people's trust in government, and that's a big, big problem.
Do you think the public has a perception as well that this is a really widespread issue?
I think there is that unfortunate perception, but there's also the reality, you know, former politicians taking these really well-paid and government-appointed jobs, often without a proper recruitment and selection process, and that rightly raises questions in the public's mind.
I mean, the other thing that raises questions is when reports like this aren't made public for a long time, and we know the government received this report 2 years ago. There've been calls for it to be released. What do you make of it taking so long to get out there?
Look, it is pretty strange that this really important report sat on someone's shelf for a couple of years, and there were repeated calls by the Coalition, the Greens and crossbenchers to see the report. But for some reason, the government decided to sit on it.
Well, yeah, the government has said it's taken this time to make sure it got its response right, but it hasn't accepted some of the key recommendations, like one of those is banning ministerial appointments in the 6 months before an election. What do you make of the government's response?
You know, it's a step in the right direction. It does put a lot of the responsibility on ministers to be responsible, to act transparently and do the right thing. But the fact that it's not in legislation is a problem. Also the fact that, like you say, it kind of rejects a lot of the really good recommendations.
What are the biggest concerns for you? Like, where would you like to see some crackdown happening?
I think one of the biggest issues, and it kind of goes to the heart of a healthy democracy, is how laws and legislation is made. And I'm talking about lobbying. Now, lobbying, it's a important part of the democratic process, meeting politicians, putting forward ideas. But unfortunately, particularly in Canberra, there are vested interests, big business like the mining sector, gambling, big tech, that can employ literally hundreds of paid lobbyists to pressure governments. What we see is a lot of former ministers or politicians or advisors, so people that work in an MP's or parliamentarian's office, once they leave politics, literally the next day sometimes, they parachute into a really well-paid job lobbying for a private industry. Now, that's not necessarily a problem, but when, for example, you have a former Minister for Gambling or a former advisor to the Defence Minister leave politics, take all those contacts, those networks, that deep understanding about how government works, and take up a job lobbying on behalf of those same industries that are responsible for regulating, it creates a huge conflict of interest and can also create a bit of a risk for corruption. And we recently did some analysis looking at the Commonwealth, but also the other eight states and territories in Australia, and looked at their lobbying regulations and found that the Commonwealth was kind of equal last, doing pretty badly alongside the NT and the ACT. So there's a lot of room to move and improvement for the federal government in this space.
Yeah, look, Clancy, one of the other things that people might find pretty interesting is a statistic around former resources ministers going to work in that sector. What did we find out there?
Look, we had a look at resources ministers from 2001. So these are government ministers who have responsibility for regulating the mining, oil and gas sector. And we found that almost every single resources minister, with a couple of exceptions, after they left politics, surprise, surprise, they went and worked for the resources industry and, you know, took all their knowledge and contacts and information about how government works and were helping the resources industry. Now, this creates a really uneven playing field. It makes it much harder for other groups to have their voices heard and can lead to an increased risk of corruption and poor governance about how Australia deals with things like climate change and approving new mines and other important issues concerning the resources sector.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Clancy Moore, who's the CEO of Transparency International Australia, and we're talking about jobs for mates in politics, the public service. There's been a big report into this that has been made public today, a lot of people talking about it. Clancy, one of Labor's big promises before it was elected was to go hard on integrity. How do you feel the government's going? Were you hoping for more?
So every year our international secretariat puts out it's called the Corruption Perceptions Index. It's a global ranking of every country and their perceived levels of corruption in the public sector. 100 being very clean and 0 being highly corrupt. Since the Albanese government was elected, Australia's gone up from 73 out of 100 to 77, and we were in the top 10 last year for a long time, first time in a long time. So the trend is getting better. However, we have seen a few kind of slightly worrying moves recently, including attempts by the government to make changes around freedom of information law. So I think overall, the government's doing okay federally, but there's heaps of room to improve. And 77 out of 100, I'd like to see Australia being 90 out of 100 and really being a world leader.
Yeah, because we have seen some reporting over the past few months earlier this year about the Albanese government being worse than the previous Morrison government in producing documents. How does that sit with you and your research?
Look, they have had a bit of a bad track record with producing those really important Senate documents. It's worth noting that in 2012, we were actually 85 out of 100 on that 100-point index. And then there was 10 years or so of decline. Your listeners probably also remember former Prime Minister Scott Morrison appointing himself in secrecy to 5 ministerial roles without telling anybody, which is a huge kind of encroachment of secrecy. I think the trend is getting better for Australia, but there's still so much more to be done. And ultimately, it comes back to people's trust in democracy, how the system works, and getting better laws and policies that help all Australians. And that's what we're about.
It's definitely something that young Australians are pretty keen to talk about. And we've seen it really increase in interest amongst younger people, younger voters, in terms of things that are important to them. So thank you for breaking it down. Clancy Moore from Transparency International Australia. Appreciate your time.
Absolute pleasure.
And we still have a lot of messages coming through on this. Someone says, I reckon it wouldn't be so bad if these politicians were actually qualified. Another person says, such double standards. My wife works in government and she has to jump through all these hoops to employ people. It's really sad to see stuff happening without all the checks and balances. Ellie from Melbourne says, Is it such a bad thing that staffers who have valuable industry knowledge go and use that knowledge elsewhere? That's what Ellie is asking. But then another person says, it's like they say, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Hack!
The technology for a lot of the current records we listen to is 100 years old.
On Triple J.
How do you support your favourite musicians? Apart from heading to their gigs and picking up some merch, vinyls are obviously a really popular way. And people love them. They obviously look good, sound good. They're not green though, are they? They're not really sustainable because vinyl is a type of plastic. So is there a way of consuming physical music while still thinking about the environment? Well, it turns out the industry is actually trying to figure out a bunch of ways to be greener, including with vinyls. Ariana Lucente explains.
So what we've got here is a record press is made from 3 parts. They all have an extruder, a press and a trimmer. So as you can see, Zach's just made a puck, which is now in the press.
Vinyl records might be having a revival, but there are still only 3 factories in Australia that make them.
That will now be compressed. So that's a molten puck of PVC.
Steve Lynch owns Program Records here in Thornbury in Melbourne, and we're looking at what he just called a PVC puck, basically a lump of vinyl that's about to get pressed into shape.
A big component of the regrind is the flash that you're about to see get trimmed off.
So that just trimmed it.
We do leave a trail of trash behind us, and as a musician, I feel like that's even more so.
Steve Lynch's factory makes records for lots of Aussie artists, including Stella Donnelly, whose album Love and Fortune dropped recently.
I just asked the question, actually, what have you got, like, in terms of saving on materials? And they were like, oh, we can do a regrind option. And I was like, what's that?
Stella Donnelly's record is made from regrind vinyl, basically factory offcuts and other unused vinyl.
All those bits that are going to go in the bin, they've ended up on my record. And actually, at the time I was in there, they were pressing the Big Thief record. So I'm hoping some of their talent has rubbed off on me somehow.
There is something about holding the piece of art and being able to play something that's physical.
Whether it's nostalgia, stepping away from the major streamers, or moves by fans to support their favourite artists, people are buying physical music again.
For Berish Balander, the CEO of Green Music Australia, a non-profit for music and climate, that presents some problems, especially with 80% of records bought here being made in either Europe or North America.
Most of the emissions impacts of a vinyl record is coming from the fact that it's made overseas and it's being shipped over here by aeroplane. 300% more emissions is coming from that.
It can be hard for artists and labels to predict how many records they're going to sell.
It's sort of a dirty secret of the industry. Like, you wouldn't hear about it because no one would want to talk about units that haven't sold. I've heard reports of millions of units being dumped in landfill.
And there's the plastic issue. Records are made from PVC.
From about 1950 to the year 2000, all the major commercial recording formats, LPs, 45s, cassettes, and CDs, they're all made out of different kinds of plastic, but they are all essentially plastic.
Dr. Carl Devine is from the University of Winnipeg in Canada. He wrote a book called Decomposed, The Political Ecology of Music.
Early on in writing that book, I definitely found that the same people I knew who were most likely to buy organic groceries and want to drive electric cars were also the people who really were heavily invested in vinyl records, which are these products of fossil fuel and the plastics industries.
With King Gizzard, all of their stuff we've done in recent times has been on regrind vinyl.
Back at the Thornbury factory, Steve Lynch says what he's trying to do is fix all three of those problems by making vinyl locally, working with artists to get the amount of records needed right, and by experimenting with something being done by artists like Billie Eilish overseas, biovinyl, which uses cooking oil instead of fossil fuels to manufacture the PVC.
We're offering a locally made lower carbon compound. No resin has been imported.
Plus, they recycle dead stock on site.
We have taken records back, some made by us, some not made by us, some of which we've processed back into our regrind.
And new tech is being developed to make records out of PET, the plastic used for water bottles. So could community and artist demand make music greener?
This is just kind of the start for me in trying to implement more environmental shifts in my practices.
Our culture needs to evolve past one of consumption, and Australia is just really well placed to be leading that shift.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente reporting there. Lots of thoughts from vinyl lovers on the text line. Right, we're going to move on, though. We're going to talk about the F1.
Hack!
I fully believe whether it's this year, whether it's next year, Oscar Piastri will get that championship.
On Triple J.
Yeah, if you're into Formula One, it is a tense and exciting time. We're coming up to the last race of the season, the final round in Abu Dhabi next weekend. And for the first time in more than a decade, more than two drivers are in contention for the world title. And one of them is our very own Oscar Piastri. So a lot of Australians very excited, and not just Australians, young motorsports fans all around the world. So what does he have to do to win? Let's ask someone who is right across this. Elle Baillieu is co-host of Paddock 43, which is a podcast all about the F1. Elle, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
No, thank you for having me.
How are you feeling heading up to the final lap of the F1? It must be an exciting time for you.
It's incredibly exciting, but the intensity in my body, I think someone needs to check my heart rate because it's just been super high all week and we still have a few more days to go.
Yeah, everyone is really pumped for this. No doubt Oscar Piastri also feeling that anxiety. How likely is it that he could get there, that he could take out this title?
It is possible. Nothing is impossible just at the moment. For Oscar to get it, he pretty much needs to win the race and also ensure that Lando and Max do not finish on the podium. I think Max could finish third, but Lando needs to stay off that podium. So it's possible. We haven't seen this since, I think it was 2010, having three drivers in contention for the driver's champion. And I just want Oscar to get it so bad. I think he deserves it. I think we deserve it as a country as well. You know, to have someone in such an elite sport like F1 at this level is massive.
Yeah, he's had a couple of setbacks though lately, hasn't he? What's been going on over the past few weeks?
It all started back in Baku when people thought that maybe there was some sabotage going on from McLaren, that they thought they were preferencing Lando. You know, they have this thing, McLaren, corporate player rules, right? and everything has to be even and fair. No driver is number one driver like other teams where they might have number one driver, such as Mercedes. The number one driver last year was Lewis Hamilton compared to George Russell, and now that's switched. So McLaren have papaya rules, and what has happened here is there was an incident and Oscar was asked to give the position back to Lando because Lando was winning the race despite Oscar having the top points and being in front for the driver's champion. Now, this has continued on. There's been loads of things happening over the last couple of months like this. And as a result, Lando has crept up that ladder and he took over Oscar in those points for the driver's champion. So a lot of people are saying, is it sabotage? Is something going on? Have they preferenced Lando because he is British? It's a British team. He has a more of an online presence and fan base. So anything is possible.
So do you think a lot of fans or Oscars fans are pretty angry with McLaren?
Yeah, the internet is riling. You just have to go into a comment section and just see it. People attack McLaren all the time. McLaren at one point posted celebration photos on the podium with Lando in there when they won the Team Constructors Championship. And this was a few weeks back and Oscar was not present in the photo. He was still in the media pen and fans just came for them. Oscar's been having this support all over the world, which has just been amazing. Is there sabotage? We will never know. I don't think sabotage is probably the right word to even use. But, you know, it's disappointing that, you know, they haven't preferenced Oscar in some scenarios, and he seems to sort of been having a sort of that seediness, I guess, coming from them. But we really hope that preferencing them now is sort of stopped. And what they did, like this week in Qatar, was they didn't pit when everyone else did pit, and they wanted to keep it the same and keep it even, and it bit them in the butt. So I don't know what's going to happen this weekend. It's scary.
Yeah, there's a lot of possibilities. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Elle Baillieu, who's co-host of the Paddock 43 podcast. We're talking about the F1 coming up to the season finale. It's all building up to the next week. Elle, what do you reckon of this rivalry between Oscar and Lando? Because they're kind of friends as well at the same time, aren't they? Like, do you think this makes it more exciting?
I think it makes it way more exciting to have two people on the same team, you know, going for the same trophy, essentially. But, you know, at the end of the day, they are teammates, so they are going to be friends. But are you always friends with everyone that you're competing with? Like, you know, it's such a question of, I don't know if I would, you know, you probably start keeping your cards close to your chest, but also they have to do a lot together. So these guys are professionals in and out, especially when it comes to the media and especially when it comes to, you know, dealing with these sort of things. They're high stress environments. I mean, they're going into corners at 250k an hour, you know, things that we couldn't imagine doing, and incredible G-force on their necks, just turning back and forth for an hour and a half straight or more. So are they friends? We don't know, but I think they get along well. And that's always nice to see anyway.
What do you think is next for Oscar after this race? Like, if he's not successful, if he doesn't take out the title, do you think it is only a matter of time?
I think it's only a matter of time until he wins his own championship, his own driver championship. Whether that's with McLaren, I don't know. Oscar is only 3 years into his F1 season. Lando's, I think he's, what is he, 5 or 6, I think. So he's been around for a little bit longer. McLaren have really stepped up their game as a team. Whether Oscar stays in McLaren in the future, don't know. He is signed on, but it just seems like anyone can get out of contracts these days. You know, we just have to look at any other sport, really. And you're like, what? I thought you were contracted. So we'll see what happens with Oscar. I think McLaren is a great home for him, but also you want a team that respects you and pushes you to be your best. And if there is something internal going on, then maybe that's not the right fit, but we'll find out, because this guy, he's going to be a champion and he is going to get that trophy one day. If it's not this year, it's 100% next year, and he'll be fighting hard for it.
Yeah, it's been an amazing rise to success as well for Oscar Piastri. As you say, in just a few short years, he's really managed to prove himself not only to Australian fans but to the world as well. I mean, Elle, what are you going to be doing for the big race? What are your plans?
Well, I'm currently at the moment watching my phone, waiting to see if my tickets have come through for Abu Dhabi. And if they have, I will be jumping on a plane Thursday night, very last minute. I'm really hoping that comes through. If anyone out there wants to shout me some tickets, let me know.
Wow. Okay. So you really, everything's up in the air at this point. You don't know what you're doing.
No idea what I'm doing. If I'm not doing that, I'll be watching somewhere. It is at midnight, so it's going to be a late one, but I really hope to be on the track there. And also, I just think it's important for, you know, to have Aussie females over there in the creative space like Pat and I do, and help represent our country and sort of communicate it back, and especially in such a tight thing. So, oh my God, I hope I'm there.
We all hope you're there too. L Value from the Paddock 43 podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
And that's all we've got time for on Hack for now.